We're continuing the interview with Terry Lemon. It is April 19th, 2005. We're in La Grande, Oregon.
All right, so we were talking about, we were finishing up with the Globe Furniture Store. You were working as a salesman, and anything else about that particular job that you did before we move on to real estate?
No, not really.
Okay.
No.
So next you went to the Real Estate School of Oregon. Where was that?
That was in Portland. It was held in the Masonic Building in downtown Portland.
And you said that you went to the school in January of 74?
Actually, I went in November 73, and I began work in January of 74.
Right. What kind of coursework was it? Tell me about that, and then how it's changed today.
Well, at the time, there wasn't anything that was required by the state to get a license other than just pass the test. And the test was given monthly in Salem at the fairgrounds, and cost $25 to take the test. And you could take it every month for maybe three or four times, and then if you didn't pass, then you had to wait a period of time, being 3 months or something like that, before you could take it again. But there was no education required, unlike today. So, but to pass the test, it was a long test. It took all afternoon to take. It was a really involved test, and without a fair amount of knowledge, you couldn't pass it. It wasn't the kind of a test you just passed by luck. It was too long, too involved.
So the coursework was not real estate coursework. It was actually coursework, or the course was actually designed for you to take the test.
The course was designed to take the test, but in the design of the course, it was you had to have a lot of real estate knowledge. They concentrated on real estate law practice. Most of the fields of real estate were involved, because the test was pretty comprehensive and covered just most everything, every field of real estate. So the test was kind of a crash course, lasted 2 weeks, and you'd go to school 8 hours a day and then spend half the night studying and then do it again the next day. And then at the end of that time, you had to sign up to take the state test, which is usually within 2 weeks of that. Mine was just right at the end of it. I finished the school at the end of a week, and then on the next Monday took the test.
Were the fees for that test separate, or were they built into the tuition for the school?
No, they were separate, completely separate entity. The state test was put on by the real estate agency.
Tell us about that exam. Where was it held?
Well, the exam was held at the fairgrounds in Salem, and it averaged, when I took it, there was about 1,200 people that took the test. No, I take that back. There was 1,500 that took it. There was 1,200 taking the salesman's test and 300 taking the broker's exam. And I was in the salesman's test. You had to have 3 years experience before you could take license, 3 years experience before you could take the broker's exam.
So did you eventually take that one?
I did not. I never did have a broker's license, no. But at the time, the pass rate on the test was about 12 to 15% pass rate. And the failure rate would have been what was left out of that, being around 85% failure rate. And mostly because there was no requirements to take the test other than pay the fee. There was no education required. Today, it's completely different. You have to have education completed, hours recorded of education, and a lot of prep work to take that test, and those numbers have just about reversed. In fact, they're better than reversed. The pass rate's 90% or so. The numbers are down a lot from what they were then, but the pass rate's much higher.
So they actually, these days, they build specific coursework about various topics in real estate for you to study as well.
They do. Yeah, you've got to cover three different fields in real estate, and each one has a little built-in test with it. They're done with private schools do that around the state now, but you've got to have those hours logged and classes completed before you can apply to take the state exam. Now,
were you ever qualified to teach any of these courses by your experience?
Well, from experience, I would have been probably
qualified.
Never did. No. experience would have qualified me probably to teach all of them, I imagine.
Did you pass the test on the first try?
I did, yeah.
How'd you feel about that?
Well, it was a relief because I knew at the time that the pass rate was pretty low, and of course, you go through a test, if you've had experience taking tests, and I'd had a lot of experience because of going to college, and I wasn't too long, I was 3-4 years out of college, so I was still in the mental mode of knowing how to take tests, and that went a long ways. So I felt pretty good about it when I completed it. You had to have a 70% pass rate to 70% pass rate on it, and I can remember looking around the classroom at people of all different ages, and there was several people in there that were probably 50 years of age, 60 years of age. And I could see a lot of panic look on a lot of faces. People look at that test and just were overwhelmed with it. And either they hadn't been to school to study for it, or hadn't had the education, or they didn't know how to take a test. And one fella that was sitting beside me, it was his fourth time he'd taken it.
So we're finishing up talking about real estate school itself. Do you recall what your score was? Did they tell you at that time?
At the time, you didn't. If you passed, you didn't know your score. If you failed, they gave you your score.
So you passed and never did know.
Never knew. I felt pretty good about the test, but did not know my score at the time. And the test at the time was written by people in the real estate agency that were not trained in writing tests. And so it was a very ambiguous test. It was not a good measure of your knowledge. Unlike today, they have professional testing agencies that write those exams. And so it's geared much more professional tests, far superior than what they were 30 years ago.
So then next you went to work for a real estate company?
I did. I worked for Lester Real Estate, and it was the only company I'd worked for. Worked for a man's name that owned it was Russell Lester, who had acquired the company from his father. So it was an old-time LeGrand real estate company. And I worked for him until actually I retired from active real estate practice in 2002. Was there, full time all that time. Saw several swings in the real estate market. The real estate market's very cyclical, and there were several ups and downs times through all that time. But I stayed at it full time, and that's all I did for that period of time until I retired. Did mostly sales, did some developing, built several homes for resale, built rental properties during that time. Sales were still the mainstay, but that was a pretty strong sideline.
Now, was this at the time you began to buy or build rental properties for your own?
Well, it was. I bought some older properties in the mid 70s, and then actually built some in the late 70s, early 80s. Built several homes for resale during that time, but I built several properties I still own today. Built at that time, and bought several through that time. Most of them I still own. I've sold a few of them over the years. Some of the older ones I've sold, I don't know any longer.
So, although you have retired completely from real estate, you still do manage property?
I do, yeah, manage my own property. Mm-hmm. Right.
Were there any out-of-the-ordinary homes that you built for resale in the area?
Well,
anything out-of-the-ordinary?
No, most of them were fairly standard type homes of the late 70s. built two nicer homes in Island City in what's called Mountain View Edition. They were larger homes of the 2,000 square foot variety and larger, and built one of them on a lot out there that was that had been vacant for some time, and it was all built up around this particular lot. And I was in sales, you know, doing that at the time, and I'd asked about that lot a few times, and I'd had several other salespeople tell me, who I felt were not as well, saying, well, that lot was tied up. I don't remember, it had legal, a lot of legal problems, or it was in an estate or something, and we just couldn't buy it. No one could sell it. And I thought, well, okay, I'll just look a little further. So I went up to the courthouse and come to find out the lot had been foreclosed on for property taxes. Delinquent property taxes, and to buy the lot, all you had to do was pay the back property taxes. So I paid the $5,000 in back property taxes and a few hundred dollars in legal fees, and I was a proud owner of that lot. So I built a really nice home for resale on it. And it's just, as you drive into Mountain View Edition, I don't see that's an area kind of across from the golf course down McAllister Lane. But
you considered that a bargain deal?
Well, I did, because I just bought another one for about twice that much further into Mountain View Edition, just within months of that. Same size of lot, basically. And so it was really a bargain. And it was kind of funny. I was one of those things you're sort of happier with yourself about, because you'd had quite a few people tell you that, no, that can't happen, and you made it happen. So just from having enough knowledge to explore it and know what to do about it and what to do with it, so it turned out to be a good investment and made a good resale, house for resale.
You were telling me that you sold a particular home to a basketball coach.
Well, I did, and I remember who that was. It was the assistant basketball coach for the Chicago Bulls. Was in the LeGrand area, and he married a local lady, or was local at one time, from the Bornkamp family in LeGrand, which was an old family that had been LeGrand for years and years and years. She was part of that, and anyway, she married the assistant coach for the Chicago Bulls, and at that time, that was in the I don't know when they were married. He was here looking for a home, anyway, in the late 70s, early 80s, and I'd showed him, he wanted a home around the golf course, and we'd looked at a couple of homes there, but to back up a minute, what he was known for with the Chicago Bulls, he was a coach that developed their triangle offense.
What was his name?
And his name was Tex Winter. And at the time, he gave me a business card with the Chicago Bulls red bull head emblem on it. And that was one of those things that you kind of hang on to. I put it in my box of business cards that I keep forever, and rather than my other boxes you keep for a little while and get rid of. And
you still have that.
And I still have it. I haven't found it yet. I was going to do that. But,
now you said
but anyway, Tex, yeah. We looked at a home, and he didn't buy anything. And he just, you know, kind of left town and thought, well, he'd deal with it later. So 10 years he came back, almost exactly 10 years he came back. That same home on Country Club Lane by the golf course was for sale again. In fact, it sold. I'd been involved in a couple of sales on the home between the time he had first looked at it and the 10 years that ensued to the time that he came back to LeGrand. And so that home was for sale again, and he ended up buying it 10 years later for about 2.5 times of what he could have bought it for 10 years before.
Did he buy it from you?
I had it listed, and he bought it from another salesperson in the office. So I was involved in the sale in it.
So sometimes when this happens, the property is listed under you as the agent, so does that mean you get split then?
Sure,
yeah.
Listing agent gets part of the fee, and selling agent does, the office does.
Did you show him that house 10 years prior?
I did. Yeah, I spent a lot of time with him. In fact, I was on vacation and out of the office when he came back, and I didn't end up working with him. He got started with another salesperson, and so they just followed through on it and completed the sale. But
do you know if they still own that house?
I think they have since sold it. He was going to remodel it and do a lot of work on it, and it never happened, and I think that they decided they didn't want to live in the Grand, and he's I believe he's probably since retired because he followed Phil Jackson from Chicago to L.A. and was his assistant there. And it was during that time that I think they sold the home here, which has just been a few years ago.
My notes next tell me that we were going to talk a little bit about a hopeful deal with the industrial park.
Well, there's been a real push in the last 1 to 2 years to develop for the development of a industrial park, light industrial park, on the corner of Geckler and Highway 30. There's a fairly good-sized parcel being 50 to 80 acres thereabouts. That's the East Oregon Development Corporation and the City of LeGrand have really been interested in developing that into an industrial park. And it appears that it's going to happen. There's been lots of work done on it, and looks like that'll probably come to pass. But I think the spark for that, I was involved in 10 plus years ago. Campgrounds of America came to LeGrand, the KOA, looking for a site for a campground. And they had one in Boise and one in Portland, but they wanted something in between, and decided LeGrand would be a good place for it, being kind of the hub of the Tri-County area and being on the interstate. So I looked for property around the area big enough to accommodate them, and they wanted a 10-acre site. And so that site came up being farmland at the time, which it still is, but it was zoned farming at the time. But it was located so ideally, being just a mile or two off the interstate, just down from the truck stop and on one of the main accesses in LeGrand, being old Highway 30. They thought that'd just be a great place to be, and there was sewer and water in Geckler Lane, which they needed, and good access to it. The thing we needed to have happen is we needed a zone change, and that land was out of the city but in the urban growth line. And what that means is property out of the city limits and within the urban growth line is under the city's jurisdiction. It's designated for future city expansion development. So the city has some control of what happens there, but it's still county land, and so the county has the final say over what happens there in the way of a zone change or whatever the case might be. So we had to pursue a zone change with the city, with all the approval of the county, and that's a real project in Oregon, with the Land Conservation and Development Commission being involved at the state level, and with their statewide planning goals. Lots of work has to be done to meet those goals and to get a zone change. And so we were involved in a number of hearings with Planning Commission, City Council, County Court, and we finally got it approved. And through that whole process, there were some local interests, one being an adjoining owner and another business interest in the area that had opposed that all the way through. So when it was finally approved, they appealed that final approval to LUBA, which is the State Land Use Board of Appeals under the LCDC. And that's the appeal process that's done. That's the first state appeal that's done through the land development process at the state level. So that went through a hearing with them. That's about a 5 to 6 month program to get that resolved and back, and they remanded it back to the county for more consideration, and on the basis that the county hadn't addressed all the land use goals. Well, this process had been going on for over 2 years, and finally KOA had hung in there through the whole process. They finally just kind of lost interest in the project. It got to be so drawn out, and they got involved in other projects, and so finally they just kind of went away. But that interest in that land remained all through that time, and there's still people at the city level, LeGrand, that were here at the time and still remember well all that process and all the push to get that done and all the work that we did demonstrating that, that LeGrand needed more land for an industrial park for future industrial expansion, which we don't have. And we made a real effort, and that was one of the goals that we had to address, was a needs goal. And so there's still people that remain at the city and a lot of local business people that still thought that should happen. And that project kind of laid idle for a few years, and then it picked up again through the Union County UCDC, Union County Economic Development Corporation, their efforts, and just more interest in having more industrial lands. So that spark with the KOA and all that work was a forerunner of getting that park, the location of that park, and the value would be to the city of LeGrand to have another industrial park in that area.
Do you find it ironic that all the work you did on that is going to seem to be for naught at the time, and now it's going to perhaps happen?
Well, it does. On one hand, it's aggravating on one hand, because most real estate people, when they do that kind of work, don't get paid for it. The only time you get paid is when you close a sale. And some areas people get paid for consulting work, and you start into a project working on a an hourly basis, time material type basis, and you get paid for your work. But typically in this area, that's not the case. So you go out there and spend tons of time. And this, like I say, this went on for over 2 years. And then if your sale doesn't close, you've done that for nothing. So on that hand, it's aggravating that something like that doesn't work out. Time is money. The only thing you have to sell as a realtor is your time and expertise. On the other hand, it makes me feel good that provided a spark for something that's really needed in the community, and there's going to be a lot of good things come out of that if it comes to pass. And it appears that there's still problems to be addressed, but it would appear that that's going to happen sometime in the future. And so, that's a rewarding thing to see happen, especially with how all that got started.
And you do think that is a good use for that property?
Oh, I do, yeah.
Now, how about that original landowner that objected?
Well, he was an adjoining owner, and he's still an adjoining owner.
Is he still objecting?
He hasn't been objecting, no. Interesting, he's kind of went away on these objections.
That would seem to be a little more irony.
Right. And that was the main reason that if it hadn't been appealed, if they would have left the decision stand with the city and the county, that there would be a KOA campground there right now. And more probably the transition into an industrial park there would have been an easier road having that happened than what it is today. Because that would have paved the way for future development to take place a lot easier. There was some physical things there that had to be done with sewer and water and access, and most of those would have been addressed with KOA, and anything else that came along would have just fallen in place up there.
Before we move on to real estate changes that you witnessed during your career, what became of Lester Real Estate Company?
Well, Russell Lester, the owner, wanted to partly retire 2 years ago, actually in 2002. He sold Lester Real Estate, the business, and the building property to ERA, which was a local real estate franchise just down the street, two blocks. And they're in that our old Lester Real Estate location. They moved out of their leased property into the building we were in at 1702 4th Street.
So is the name Lester Real Estate dissolved?
It is, yeah.
And Russell Lester, is he retired?
Actually, he still works. He kept an office there, works, he's a broker, but not what's called a designated broker. He doesn't have any management responsibilities in the office. He just works with kind of a salesperson.
For ERA?
For ERA, right.
Okay. Talk about a little bit about the changes in the real estate business between the time you started and the time you've retired or recently.
Well, there's been, there was probably 50% more real estate offices in LeGrand in the 70s when I started. There was a number of offices here that aren't here now. There were more salespeople, probably 30-40% more active salespeople in the area. The businesses, the real estate companies that are here now are most of them larger. They have more people working for them, and there are quite a bit fewer numbers. And Union County Board of Realtors numbers are down, probably from an all-time high, maybe in the late 70s. The business has changed. Well, I don't know that the business has changed. The laws have changed over the years. The licensing requirements have changed. There's your responsibility as a realtor and what you need to do in your agent responsibilities to your clients, whether you're working for a buyer or seller, has changed tremendously. There's been much more, many more laws that have came about, increasing your responsibilities to your client as opposed to the way they were in 1974.
I think you mentioned that the schooling requirements have changed, that you now don't just study for a license, you actually have to take coursework in schooling.
Right, right. Yeah, there are still some schools to attend to study for to pass a license exam, but there's also required schools that you have to take, and so many hours of schooling. And the license laws just went through another big revision in the last 2 years, making everyone a broker. Not everybody don't have a salesman's license and a broker's license. Everybody's a broker. And that increased the schooling a lot, and probably doubled the amount of schooling you need, the number of hours you need. Change the licensing requirement, the test from being a salesman's test to a broker's test.
Would you have found yourself in a position of having to go back to take a class or a course if you stayed in the business?
I would. Yeah.
Would that have been? Did that have any influence upon your decision to retire?
No, it didn't.
You had already planned.
I'd already planned to retire. Right.
You talked about some hard times for real estate in the 80s and depression and.
Well, it did, and the real estate business cycles. Probably the hardest cycle the local area went through, and when I mean I say cycle, I mean the real estate environment, financing, everything associated with real estate industries cycles, and in the 80s. We went through a downward trend, the whole country did, and LeGrand's always been a little more isolated as far as anything that was impacting the whole country. It was a little delayed getting to LeGrand, and then LeGrand was always a little longer coming out of it. And California went into a real estate down cycle in about 80, 81. It didn't really hit LeGrand until a year or two later, 82, 83. And we went through a time where interest rates were high and the unemployment rate was high statewide, locally it was high. And so real estate sales really plunged. And there was a number of rental properties. There was three or four different state agencies that came into the area and built low-income, low-cost housing at the time, apartment complexes. And the result of that was just flooded the market with rental property. And the impact was that it just devastated the local rental market. It was very hard to rent property during that time. And there was also a time when people were wanting to sell their homes and couldn't because the market was flooded with homes for sale. And when that happens, values go down because what sets value is supply and demand. So we had a high supply and a low demand, and values started down and it continued down, values dropped by an average of about 30% locally. And what happens is people that haven't owned a home very long, their home gets to be worth less than what the mortgage is on it. So if you sell your home, you've got to sell it for more than what market value is just to pay your mortgage off. And that doesn't happen. And so there were a lot of property foreclosures. People couldn't pay. Some people, you know, they moved for all different reasons, all the normal reasons, some of it being unemployment, and had to leave their homes in a very poor rental market. The market was flooded with rentals. They couldn't rent their home, and they couldn't sell it for what the mortgage was on in a lot of cases. So it led to a lot of property foreclosures. And there was a lot of foreclosures in the area. All the banks had to deal with foreclosures. And I, you know, always contended the difference between a recession and a depression. A depression is when you lose your home. And that's what happened here. There was a number of property foreclosures. A lot of rental properties were foreclosed on because people couldn't rent their properties and couldn't subsidize the mortgage enough to keep payments current.
Did that affect you any? Because
well,
it appears you were managing property by then.
Yeah, it did. I survived it okay. I didn't lose any property. Made it work, and it was very difficult.
Okay, so you were telling me about the vacancy rate in your property,
right?
Sometimes 50%.
Right. And those kind of vacancy rates make you lay awake at nights wondering how you're going to make ends meet the next day. But I was fortunate enough to make it all work and survive it. A lot of people weren't. A lot of people lost rental properties, lots of them. And I've had as a salesperson, I had people come to me and just beg me to sell the rental property, and there was no buyers for it. You couldn't give a rental property away because who wanted to buy something that you had to turn around and start subsidizing?
So you never had to give up any of your property?
I didn't give up anything. No, I made it all work.
Very fortunate. So now, I think that this rental property is where you transitioned to now. You talked about leaving the office in 2002. You don't apparently just walk away from real estate or
take
your gold watch and retire
of
thing.
Not really. If you're a conscientious person and care about your clients, you just don't all of a sudden say, well, I'm going to retire and walk away from you. You've got to start winding down, and I started winding down in the fall of 2001, taking less listings and trying to get involved in less sales and any type of a sale that looked like it was going to continue on for more than 30 or 60 days. I'd refer to someone else, another salesperson in the office, or as listings came in, you typically take listings for 6 months is an average listing time, and so I would refer listings to other salespeople. Just looking ahead to the spring of 2002, that, you know, when I finally walked away, I wasn't going to walk away from anything.
And
as it worked out, my last listing that I had was a lot on the north side of town, and I think the month I decided to leave, that sold. So
was
I had
that in March.
That was in March. So I had no listings and no sales when I left. Everything was done. I felt good about that. I didn't have to leave anything up in the air or really turn around and walk away from any clients.
So at this time, then, you just have your rental property and that's a business of your own?
It is.
How many properties do you have?
Yeah, I've got about 20 properties.
Here in LeGrand?
Yeah.
All in LeGrand?
Yeah.
Trade organizations that you belong to, here, Union County Board of Realtors.
Well, most of them were just business oriented. Union County Board of Realtors, which is a local real estate organization. The Rent Owners Organization.
How long were you with the Board of Realtors?
Well, I actually joined when I went to work for Lester Real Estate. That's an organization that's been around for a lot of years. And it's affiliated with the Oregon Association of Realtors, and that's a trade organization, and it's an organization that sets business practices and how you conduct yourself, and they have a code of ethics you ascribe to, and standards of practice and ways you conduct yourself and your business. Not all real estate agents are realtors. Most are, fortunately, but some aren't. And so this is an organization that's not real estate agents. It's a realtor organization, which is a trade name.
Are you still involved with them?
I'm not.
Did you hold any positions of authority?
I was on the board of directors for a number of different times for several years. I never held an elected, I never held an office, but I was on the board of directors.
Then we were beginning to talk about the Northeast Oregon Rental Association.
Right.
What's that about?
Well, that's an organization of rental owners. They're a state organization with local branches, Union County being one, and it's a trade organization also. You pay dues to belong. There's some real educational values in belonging to that. It keeps you in touch with the latest rental laws that change every other year when the legislature meets. Every 2 years the rental laws change somewhat. There's a tremendous amount of forms to deal with that the organization creates forms and updates them, keeps them current to what the current state laws are, and makes it much easier to conduct your business and be on top of it and be in compliance with the latest landlord-tenant laws.
Same question with this one. When did you join? Do you still belong? And did you hold any offices?
Well, I joined. That organization was in its infancy when I bought my first rental property in 1975, or it didn't exist. I don't recall which came first, but I joined in the mid-70s, and that was early on in the life of that organization. I'm still a member. It's an organization to pay dues into. Really, that's only a requirement for membership. But it's all members of people that own rental property. That's the purpose of belonging to it. And I haven't held an office in it. No. They sponsor educational seminars through the year. They have state conventions once a year. LeGrand hosted about 4 or 5 years ago at the state convention, and they have trade shows, trade schools, educational seminars at their conventions. Usually they're a 3 or 4 day convention.
So is that a big organization for this area?
Well, there's, remember, I don't recall the membership numbers, maybe 50, 60 members, something like that, locally. But it is a statewide organization.
Next, I have a note that you have held vestitures at the church, at your church. And first of all, what is a vestiture, and which church did you do that with?
Well, I'm a member of St. Peter's Episcopal Church, and I was raised in a Christian church. And when my wife and I were married, she was a cradle Episcopalian, being born into the church. And so I could see that probably I wasn't going to win her over to the Christian church, so I became a member of the Episcopal Church. And when we were married in '66, and I've been a member ever since.
I think I used the wrong term. I'm sorry. Vestry, I think.
I'm getting there.
Okay.
I'll correct that.
Great. Good.
The vestry is the board of directors at the church, and I've served on that in years past for several years. And we're active in the church and different committees and groups. And
now, one of the notes I have about this vestry was they by your experience, you managed the rectory.
Oh, I
did.
What was that
about?
Being with my rental experience, there's a house right next door to the church, and that's been the rectory for the church. And we've had ministers in the past that have lived there, and some that have chose not to live there, and it's probably been not used as a rectory for the past 25 years, more so than it's been used as a rectory. And during those times, I've been the one to manage that as a rental property. And coincidentally, we just had our current rector just 2 months ago moved into the rectory and rented that property. So now it's a rectory again rather than a rental property.
So did that, was that successful? I assume that brings income then into the church?
It was, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it was an income producer for the church.
The next organization that I have listed here is the University Foundation at Eastern Oregon University. Tell me about that.
Well, the past few years, and my wife's been involved more than I have, but I've been on the foundation at the university for, 10, 15 years probably. And the foundation is a fundraising, the basis of the foundation is fundraising for the school. And I continue to be on that. We just did make it's a financial commitment to the President's Club, that foundation, which is increasing your level of donating to the foundation.
And I think we talked last time, what is the requirement, or what is the, how do you get into that?
Well, the President's Club is basically, and the basis of the foundation is to generate funds, and that's the purpose of the membership, is to do that either through fundraising projects, more so through donating, and they look for other donors to donate property, large donors to donate blocks of money to the foundation, and then the membership makes a commitment to donate through the year. The President's Club is a level of is a group of, I don't want to say it. It's a level of membership that's you belong to by what you donate, and that level you have to make a 5-year commitment of $1,000 a year to the foundation
minimum
to be a member of the President's Club.
How long have you been a member of the President's Club?
Actually, just this year. We've become a little more interested in since our retirement and being involved with the college and foundation.
But you had belonged to the foundation previously.
I have, yeah.
Did you have any involvement with the fundraising that went on for the new science complex? That I know that there was quite a bit of work that had to take place to... my understanding is that there were some matching funds that had to be...
There was, yeah.
Had to be raised.
Part of the donations of the foundation covered that, and we donated to that. And then they had a few large donors to that project.
Now, what do the members do typically, you know, in this foundation, in their meetings? I mean, do you generate ideas for fundraising, or do you just manage the money, or what exactly?
Well, there's
being a member.
Part of the organization manages the money. It's part of it goes to scholarships, projects that need funding through the college. Through the year, they have one meeting a year among of the whole group, and it's an annual meeting that's normally held in May. The President's Club meets as a more of a social type function probably 4 or 5 times during the year. The 10 plays at the college. We've got a they call it gala, presidential gala, that's being held April the 30th in the alumni room at Ackerman. And that's mainly just a social event.
Do you serve on any particular committee of that organization?
I don't, no.
General member?
Just a general member, right.
All right, so we're now in retirement. And I know that there's no cobwebs being collected around here, that you're staying pretty busy. What are some of the things that you do in your post-employment phase?
Well, the rental business keeps me busy somewhat. That's a part-time job. you know, with that many properties, there's always someone coming or going, and we should deal with vacancies, re-renting properties, and everything that's involved with that. My wife and I have traveled quite a little bit. We just booked in for another Caribbean cruise the other day, which will keep us going next, which will happen next spring, that we're looking forward to. And last, a year ago in September, we took a trip across the country with our RV, went to Tennessee to see her uncle in Tennessee. We were gone for a month or so. We've been to Arizona 2 months this winter.
With your RV?
With her RV.
So you belong to an RV organization?
We belong to Good Sam Club, which is a national organization. We belong, but really we don't function in it. We have friends that we travel with, and we've had an RV since 1985, and we use it around locally. We used to take our kids down to the Snake River a lot with a boat and an RV. That gave us a place to stay, and the boat gave us something to do. And that was a highlight of their life, was to go down there, and we spent 2 or 3 weeks a year there around locally. But since we've been retired, we've expanded our horizons some, traveled a little bit more. We've been to California to see Mary Gill's sister several times, and Arizona, trip back east. We plan to do more of that, you know, even with the cost of transportation going up like it has been. But,
what are some of your hobbies?
Well, we probably, when we're home, I'm not a model airplane builder or any certain hobbies. We, our home's situated on about an acre that I happen to be the chief gardener for. That keeps me busy.
Does that pay a lot?
It's a very high-paying job. In fact, the highest pay is I get to continue on my employment without being asked to leave if I don't do my job.
Oh, so you're not an at-will employee.
Servitude.
Are you a sportsman? And, what kind of?
Well, I used to hunt and fish a lot. My son and I, my father, we used to hunt a lot together. I used to hunt a lot with my father and fish, and then my son and I did, and he's been gone for a couple of years. My son has been left home a couple of years ago when he graduated, and so my hunting and fishing activities have kind of wound down. Still fish some, yeah.
How about that piano?
Play for my own entertainment, and I'm getting to be kind of a rusty piano player, but we still do some. We have our piano, it's interesting enough, is an 1870s vintage that came around the horn up to Portland and came on covered wagon to Le Grand, and it was my wife's great aunt's piano. And before she passed away, she gave it to me, and it stayed in my wife's grandmother's home, which is here in Le Grand, for a few years after that. And then we moved it actually to this home, and we built this in 1978. It's been here since. But
what was the name of the original owner, the relative of this piano?
May Neal. Well, that's actually, it was her, and my wife could tell me better, it was her parents that had the piano, and May ended up with it. May lived in Hawaii. She taught school all her life in Hawaii, but the piano remained here at her sister's, who was my wife's grandmother. And she was here one time, heard me play, and said, you know, someday I want you to have that. And so someday came, and that was in 1978, we moved it here, and it's been here ever since, so.
Do you say you're getting a little rusty on that
a little
piano?
Bit. Yeah, I don't
do you,
play
you
as much.
Have you considered checking back in with Miss Van Brocklin for a refresher?
Probably would be a good idea if I do that.
I think we missed an organization here. You told me that you had some involvement with the high school wrestling boosters. What did that involve?
Well, actually, I think that was my wife's agenda. Our son wrestled all through high school, and the booster club was just a club of parents. Mostly parents of wrestlers, it could be any adult, but mostly parents of wrestlers that supported the program, mainly through every time there was a wrestling meet here, they had a food booth that they provided food for and sold refreshments and so on for wrestling tournaments, and just kind of general support. Sometimes they'd buy things for the club or donate money sometimes if they needed, you know,
did
accessories.
Did you man those concessions?
Did some, yeah. Yeah, that was...
Sort of I have a note here that says general labor. That
general labor, yeah.
Main
yeah, right.
Uh-huh.
Great on dishes and pots and pans and the real technical stuff.
The one item we haven't talked about, and I am going to ask each of you to discuss it a little bit, is we haven't talked about your marriage. Who did you marry? And when did you do that?
Well, we were married December 18th, 1966. And we were both in college at the time.
What's your wife's name?
Maid Mary Jo Lemon. And maiden name was Pat.
Okay.
And
where did you get married?
We were married at St. Peter's Episcopal Church in LeGrand.
Now, when you talked earlier about she was born into this church and you belonged to the Christian church, did you make a conversion before the marriage?
It was an easy conversion.
Uh-huh.
I wasn't really strong in the Christian church, and I soon had it made clear to me that I was going to be a member of the Episcopal Church, and so that was an easy conversion.
Did that come about as a result of revelation or
not really
declaration?
No.
Maybe
no, it was pretty diplomatic.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I was eased into that, and that was fine. I was ready for a church to be involved in my own, and Mary Jo was really, you know, she's a cradle Episcopalian and was a strong member of the church, and so that seemed to be a pretty natural transition. And worked well for me.
When did you first meet your wife?
Well, we actually met, I was in the 7th grade and she was in the 8th grade at the junior high school. And we went together for 10 years before we were married.
Starting from the 7th
grade? Well, starting in junior high, yeah. And we went to, and we had a few breaks in between, and so we were off and on a little bit, but pretty much on through junior high and high school, mostly high school, and then into college. And then we were married. We were both in college when we were married. I had 2 years left, and she had a term left. And she was going to graduate in education, and so we were married in December. She graduated in March at the end of winter term, and then substitute taught that spring. And I continued on for 2 more years until 69 when I graduated. But she went to work as a teacher in Union, as a first grade teacher, and was a breadwinner of the family there for 2 years while I was in school.
Where did you first live?
We lived at a house over on Jackson Street, across the street from the old railroad Union Pacific roundhouse that's since been torn down. But lived there for less than a year, and then we moved to a house at 1603 L, which is just right below Ellis Street that goes in front of the college steps, and it's just a block off the front of those steps.
Did you own that house?
No, we rented it. Mm-hmm. And then we moved from there. We bought a home about 2 blocks away, our first home we bought in 69 when I graduated, only about 2 blocks away, and moved from that home to 9th Street and then to where we are today.
Did you sell yourself that house through the real estate agency?
Actually, it was before I had a license. That was in 69.
Okay.
And then when it came time to sell it, I sold it.
Uh-huh.
Right.
And then you moved here.
Built this house, bought this property in 77, built the house, moved here in 78.
And for the record, that house is 96 Walnut in LeGrand.
Right. We've been here since 78. Bought this property and then bought some more land around it. So we've got about an acre of property. It was one of the old pioneer houses was on this property right next door to us, or just off the north end of the house. There was the house was gone, but there was an old stone foundation there. And it had been there since 1860s, 1870s was when that house was built. Up this was called Old Town or Old LeGrand, and there was a road that went in front of our house, which is now Walnut Street, that went on up the hill to Morgan Lake and back in the mountains, and it was also a route that wagons came on the old Oregon Trail, went up the hill up B Street, but there was another route in front of us that continued on around, I think either into the mountains or on around the edge of the foothills, and there was a big spring that was a watering place for horses on this property, and they'd stop here and water animals and continue on. And there was a large old barn that was part of this house, the old foundation that was here when we bought the property. There was a big old barn that survived up until about 1969, back where we have a garden, and that barn was burnt down. I think it was on purpose just to get rid of it. But where our garden is, we didn't know it at the time, and we started rototilling our garden. We'd always rototill up old pieces of harness and old square nails and just all kinds of junk that you would expect to find with a barn. And that's where our garden is.
Were any of these things you found preserved?
Not really, no. Most of them were metal parts. We found a few burnt pieces of lumber boards that were remnants of burning down the barn, but the pieces that we found that were preserved at all were all metal, and of course they don't survive very well.
Was this street paved when you first came
here? It was a gravel road, pretty good gravel road, because there was homes up in the Morgan Lake area. And the people on there was no homes on this side of the street on the unpaved portion, and homes across the street. And the people across the street wanted this road paved, but hadn't had any luck because no one on the other side of the street had any impetus to get it done. And so of course, everybody shares equally on a front foot cost basis. And the people that owned the property on this side had half of the control of the street, vote wise, by property.
Here.
And so when I came along, I knew that if I bought this, I could get the street paved, because I'd done that before for other building projects. We put in a street, or I put in a street down off of B Street that I built some houses on, and so I knew the process to go through with the city to get it done, and what it took to get it done. And so we lived here for about, as soon as I bought the property, we built the house, moved in, and I went to work on getting the street paved. And about 2 years later, that came to pass. We got it paved, and everybody worked it out with the other owners. There was a lot of issues as far as right-of-ways and frontage and all sorts of things to work out with that. But I got it done, and because I had no desire to live on a gravel street or a dirt street. It was pretty dusty. There was a lot of traffic off the mountain and come off the hill pretty fast, noise of fog of dust, and the people across the street just hated that. Loved where they lived, but they hated the street. So I was able to solve that problem for everybody, me included.
Now, for the record, I believe this house is on the east side of Walnut, if I have my directions straight.
Actually, it's on the west side.
Is it on? I'm sorry, it is on the west side. I turned around in my chair, I guess.
Yeah.
How many children do you have?
Two children, son and a daughter. Son was...
What are their names?
Greg and Jennifer. Greg was born in 76 and Jennifer in 77.
And earlier we talked about the history of education in this family. They're both also Eastern Oregon graduates.
They are. They both graduated in 2000. Greg graduated in English, and Jennifer graduated in the OHSU nursing program. And she went on to work in Boise at St. Luke's. Greg went on, worked for about 2 years, year and a half after he graduated, and then he went back to school at the University of Montana and got a master's in journalism. And he lives there now, or in Hamilton, out of Missoula, and works as a journalist for a newspaper there.
I've hit almost all of my topics, and I saved one for the end because I wanted you to tell me the story again that we talked about when we first met about the water tiles in La Grande. Playing in those water tiles.
Oh,
what are they? What are the water tiles, first of all, and then tell us the story about playing around them.
Well, it's not a big story, but across South La Grande, there's two or three creeks that come out of the hills: Deal Canyon, Mill Creek. There's one other one, but anyway, they cross across La Grande from west to east, flowing downhill, and they eventually all end up in the Grand Ronde River. Through the years, those have been tiled underground, concrete, normally 4 to 6 foot diameter concrete tiles. That's all been tiled underground. In fact, I sold a home off of Sunset years ago that one of those creeks went right underneath the house. And when it ran a lot of water, you could hear water running underneath this house through this concrete tile. And there was an easement for it. It was, you know, done right. It was legal. It was all there. But that creek went right underneath this house. It was down in the ground a couple of feet, the top of the tile. But you could hear water run during a really hard runoff. But anyway, those ran down across town. And when they got to one of them got to the college property, it surfaced where Dorian East and West is now. And I was going to school at Ackerman at the time, just, you know, grade school age, just old enough to maybe get away from home to play someplace else and not be right under my parents' watchful eye. And we'd go up to the college, and that creek went underneath Dorian, which tiled underneath Dorian, and then it surfaced right on the other side, and then it went underground again, and it came out down by 12th Street where the college, I can't think of what they call it, it's a big utility building down,
physical plant,
down below the college is where it came out. So it went underneath that whole athletic field from Dorian, underneath that whole athletic field all the way down to the physical plant in about a 6-foot tile, and it was open on the Dorian end, so we thought it was just great to get inside that tile and go all the way to the other end. And when you started at one end and looked at the other end looked to be maybe the size of a dollar, of a silver dollar. It was that far through there, and it just looked like a little speck of light at the other end, and there's always water going through it. And so we would get in that tile, and boy, it was a long ways through there. It was a couple of blocks down through there underneath that field, and we'd run back and forth through that thing and thought that was a great sport, you know. And they'd ever had a big rush of water down through there, it probably could have been a little difficult on us. We might not have popped out the other end, I suppose, eventually. But
How big was the other end? It looked like a silver dollar.
Well, I think it was the same size. It was 4 to 6 feet in diameter, but we could stand up in it. And there was no grates on it or anything. It was just open. There was no grates or anything to block access to it. You could just crawl right down in it, get down. There was kind of an open ditch where it came out, and then just a short distance later, the tile was there, and the ditch led right into that tile, so you could get down in the ditch and get in the tile and go down to the other end. It was a great sport.
You just walked through it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What's become of those? Are they
still there?